Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to a new show every Wednesday at noon on the Heritage Radio Network. And you can always find us at restaurantguysradio.com.
Hello, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How you doing?
I'm just grand. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing really well. I went out to a kind of a larger New Jersey restaurant city last night and had dinner with the family. We went out, since we still don't have a kitchen, we get to eat out all the time.
Yeah, isn't that great?
For those of you who are first-time listeners, I suffered the wrath of Hurricane Irene and am rebuilding my house as we speak.
Mm. But on pontoons, I understand.
Yeah. It's given me the opportunity to do a lot of dining out, at least with the family. So, you know, we were looking for kind of a family-oriented place, and so we were walking around the downtown of this New Jersey restaurant city, kind of known for its kind of restaurant scene.
Right.
Well, we were walking around town, and I noticed that as we walked by, in one, I'm going to say, block and a half area, there were four or five little Italian trattoria kind of places. As I walked, and there's also three or four other types of restaurants in that, in this little, nice little
area,
exactly.
Yeah.
And what I saw was in the Italian trattoria, $12 to $20 an entree type places, they were full, completely full on a weeknight surprisingly, I was surprised to see how busy they were on this day.
Okay.
And then I was equally surprised as I went past. One was an American steakhouse. Another was a grill, like an ethnic grill.
Mm-hmm.
And they were almost empty.
Really?
And while the price points were $5 or $10 more in those other places, wasn't like what I expected was, well, in the Italian trattoria type places, I'm going to see families. I'm going to see, broader types of people, and because of the lower price point, that's why they're so crowded on this night. But that's not what I saw. What I saw as I went into the restaurant that I eventually ate in, which was one of the Italian trattorias, was it was adults without children, but they had chosen the more comfortable food. They had chosen the less expensive restaurant. And some of that I think is just the times that we live in now. People are looking for more comfortable food and more, they're looking for easier decisions.
You know, it's funny. There was an article, or a couple articles, talking with Danny Meyer recently in the Times about the sale. Danny Meyer is purportedly in a deal to sell his interest in 11 Madison Park, which is a Michelin mm-hmm. three-star, one of the best restaurants in New York City, and one of the most formal restaurants in New York City today, to his...
Well, still not anywhere near as formal as the restaurants we saw 10 years ago.
True. Well, actually, 11 Madison Park, I would quibble with you there. I think it approaches it, but it's not. You're right. Not there's no tie requirement.
Right. I was going to say, as far as where the way the customers are dressed and the way it's.
Yeah. Well, but in any event, it's more formal than the other restaurants in Manhattan.
Right.
Than most of the other restaurants
Correct.
In Manhattan. And Danny Meyer was saying that he feels that there's really a strong following for a small segment of the market in that formal, mm-hmm. and he occupies that niche. Interestingly, though. Danny Meyer is selling his interest in that restaurant. I've never heard of Danny Meyer selling his interest in a successful restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you have here, he said that what happened is the chef and his partner, who was working in the restaurant as well, were planning on maybe going and doing other things as well as retaining their interest in 11 Madison Park. And Danny said, it doesn't make sense that I'm going to have you two guys, partners here but competitors in other places. I don't know that I want to be a part of that. You know, why don't I just sell you to this place? But you know what? Never bet against Danny Meyer. Okay? If Danny Meyer's selling, it just strikes me that, you know, the thing about those high-end restaurants, like Michelin three-star restaurants, even in France, you can be very, very successful and bring in millions and millions of dollars. But it costs millions and millions of dollars to run those places, mm-hmm. and they don't weather financial storms too easily.
And again, for those of you who don't know, Francis and I have one restaurant is a super fine dining restaurant, and the other restaurant is an Italian restaurant, but on the higher end of that
upscale casual.
Upscale casual, exactly. So we're both of our restaurants definitely are on the plus side of fancy.
Anyway, I think though that it is interesting. I think the plus side of fancy is fine. I think that the market for that super high end restaurant is small but dedicated, mm-hmm. and I wonder at the future of that kind of restaurant.
Well, and that's what we see. We certainly see that in Stage Left, our restaurant. We see the people who are coming to that restaurant are loyal, and frankly, maybe coming even more than they were 5 years ago.
And I also think that when people have a very special night, we are who they seek out. But there are fewer people competing with us in the high end in Jersey than
that's work. Actually true. You know, there are fewer people who are in that game.
Restaurants that are in the game of like, we want to be the best in New Jersey, we want you to dress up and have and everywhere, even in the highest end places, the dress is more casual. But fewer and far between. Absolutely, I think it's a small segment of the market. It's a necessary segment of the market, but there's only room for a few places there.
So I have to share with you something that happened to me while I was in this little trattoria-esque type restaurant.
Okay.
Now the restaurant's busy. It's bustling, and so I go to the restroom to wash my hands before dinner, and you know, service is okay, but it's moving more slowly than it should. Things are taking a little longer than they should. And I go in the back, and it's an open kitchen, and one of the busboys is sitting there, and he's texting somebody on his cell phone as I walk back to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually pause, and I look over his shoulder, say, "Hey, how's it going?" And he kind of gives me a, "Huh, okay," and he goes back to texting. I'm amazed at... There's a lack of understanding that's not the right thing to do.
That's not cool.
And so, like I said, this is an open kitchen restaurant, right? So later on, I went back again to the restroom, this time to use the restroom, and one of the cooks was on his cell phone texting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, the grill's going, the fire's going, the restaurant's full. It's humming pretty good for a weeknight, like I said earlier. And I'm always amazed when I see restaurant employees not focused on what they're doing. And frankly, you know, you could say that about any job anywhere.
Yep.
You know, you're in the service industry.
A restaurant employee in service is like being on stage. Yeah. How would
exactly.
you like it if the actor whipped out his cell phone or the, you know, if the gaffer does that, you might be in a world of hurt.
Right. That's exactly that. There's the analogy that you might want to look at. There is one of the stage hands is on stage, you know, holding up a prop, and his phone rings, and you see you see one of the stage hands talking on his cell phone, and you would just be like, well,
not so good with the theater analogies. Sorry, you weren't really in the drama club. You were a football guy, right? That's you were the football team. I was the stage crew guy.
So clearly, I've used an incorrect term. Would you like to
promise not.
Where
I promise to make it not to make any. Promise not to make any football.
So you're on the line, and the ball's about to be snapped, and the guard picks up his cell phone.
Yeah, that's there you go.
It's offsides.
You got that right.
It's offsides. That's a 5-yard penalty.
We should all stick to what we know. Because the stagehands never really hold up things on stage during a performance. Never seen that. But I think everybody knows what you mean. You know, it's funny, though, because in 10 years... Everyone's going to think, why would you... First of all, the cell phone's going to be implanted in your brain, so we're not going to know whether you're on it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, your glasses are going to be a screen that reads out what's being texted to you. And people think, how could you ever possibly be disconnected from all of your friends all over the world for a minute? And your waiter's going to be playing whatever the...
World of Warcraft.
World of
Warcraft.
I was going to say, whatever is the 25 version of
World of Warcraft 27 is what it's going to be.
Right. While he's bringing you, I find that just rude. I really find that the march of tech. I mean, I sound like my grandfather maybe, but I just find it rude. But you know, I've told the bartenders behind our bar that sometimes they can tweet because we have somebody who tweets for the restaurant. And when something cool or interesting happens at the restaurant, I let one of our employees tweet.
Hate it.
You know, but then it brings in customers, and you like it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a trade off that. And again, obviously, all of our listeners are podcasters or listening through Heritage Food Network. So you are tied into the, you know, the net and well, we're to, all tied to what's in. Happening.
It's a matter of when you disconnect so you can be exclusively that's with the people kind you're of with.
My, and that's exactly my point. There comes a point where you must disconnect from all of the electronics so you can be with have an interpersonal relationship.
And if you're texting while you're waiting on a floor in service or cooking in a kitchen in service, that shows that you are not... You know, if your doctor's texting while he's operating on you, that's not so cool. What it says is, I don't respect what I'm doing enough to think that it requires my complete attention.
Correct.
And
that's exactly it. And that's exactly the way I feel when I'm in a business meeting and somebody starts to text. That's exactly the way I feel when I'm out to dinner with somebody and they pick up their phone. I feel like,
That's why it's illegal.
I'm not important enough to have your attention.
That's why it's illegal to text and drive, because mm-hmm. we know, studies have shown, that you cannot give your full attention while you're texting someone else. And so we know that it's not illegal to wait tables and drive. If you're taking every minute to wait tables, you're not trying to figure out, you're not trying to empathize with the guest, you're not trying to be mindfully present at the mm-hmm. table.
You're not trying to anticipate my needs.
You sent a message to someone else and you expect them to reply back sometime into your pocket in the next 10 minutes, and then you want to sneak away again within the next 10 minutes to respond to them, and that's how it works. So you can't be mindfully present at the table with your guests if you're texting.
What I thought, though, was remarkable about this, that neither the cook nor the busboy thought there was anything wrong with it. They were standing out in plain sight in the middle of the open kitchen, you know, right there in front of all the customers with their cell phones out texting somebody.
And I just wonder that if in 10 years, with the decline of Western civilization the way it is, if we're going to be like the
if
old...
Rome will be overthrown and...
I wonder if our way of looking at this is we're going to be like the old biddies, and of course everyone texts all the time.
I think we already are the old biddies as far as this particular issue goes. I think that most people say... You know, of course my cell phone's in my pocket. Of course I look at a text when it comes in.
You're one big biddy, I'll tell you that much. it reminds me, and I want to close with this, it reminds me of one of my favorite reviews ever of a restaurant that closed shortly after the review by our friend Anthony Giglio, who was a wonderful is still a wonderful writer, but he wrote for New Jersey Monthly magazine. And the area code in North Jersey is 973, and there was a restaurant that opened, and it had the name of the restaurant was 973. I actually ate there. It wasn't bad. And the service wasn't awesome. And Anthony wrote that as he's reviewing 973, the waiter comes over and is specialing the table, and his cell phone rings. He stops specialing the table and takes the call. I guess if you're in a restaurant named after an area code, maybe that's the etiquette there. Anyway, so he goes on, and like two more times this waiter is like, interrupts talking to the table and takes a phone call, and he ends the review with how at the end of the meal he couldn't get a check, he couldn't get coffee, you know, he's really abandoned, and he said, I'm looking everywhere for my waiter and I couldn't help but think, I wish I had his cell phone number. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. Our guest today is Kathy Gunst. She has a wonderful book, Notes from a Maine Kitchen. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network, restaurantguysradio.com, and of course you can find us on iTunes. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and our guest today is Kathy Gunst. Kathy is an award-winning author, and her new book is Notes from a Maine Kitchen.
Kathy, welcome to the show.
Hey there. Great to be here.
Kathy, why Maine?
Well, because I live here.
Okay, but why should everybody else care about Maine?
Well, you know, it's funny. Why did anybody care about Provence? I mean, we all flocked to read that book as if we were all living in some idyllic French village. I moved from New York about, it's almost 30 years ago now. We came up to Maine for 1 year. I was an editor at Food & Wine magazine, and I sublet my Manhattan apartment and came to Maine for a year, and it was going to be our year in Provence, but it was a year in Maine, and very dreamy and romantic visions. And we got here in December of all months, and it was freezing cold, and it was dark at 4:30 in the afternoon, and we were like, oh my God, what did we do?
Maine in December is one of those places where you have to shovel a parking space every time you go somewhere.
And then you have to shovel yourself out of the parking space when you want to go somewhere.
You have to shovel your brain to think straight because there's so little daylight. So we were kind of freaked out, and every time we got a little bit depressed and thought we had made a mistake, we would eat lobster. And that made things much better.
That is a strategy for coping that most of us who can afford lobster could use, really.
Well, back then, 30 years ago, when we first moved here, I mean, we were buying lobster, I kid you not, for about $3 a pound. So we had it frequently. And as soon as we would eat the lobster, we would be like, yes, this is why we came. But gradually, we started meeting all kinds of interesting people and meeting chefs and going to fish markets and talking to bakers. And before you knew it, it's, you know, 2011 and we're still here. The apartment in New York went co-op. We bought a beautiful old farmhouse here, and life has been really good despite the winter.
You know, you spend a lot of time in the book talking about lobsters and lobstering, and you talk about lobstermen in the book. Tell us a little bit about the lobstering life in Maine.
Well, lobster is huge. It's a big part of the economy still, and I was lucky enough to spend a weekend up in Deer Isle, Maine, which is a spectacular place, and I met a third-generation lobsterman named Pearl Hardy, who is a real character. I mean, you sit down to talk to this guy, and 4 hours later, you get back up. And he had a lot to say about lobster and traditions, and I wrote an essay trying to tell his story as just a small example of what it's like for many lobster men and women, talking about some of the traditions in the state and what a tough field it is to get into. Like, for instance, if you guys decided we've had it with the restaurant business and radio and New Jersey and New York area and we're going to go to Maine and become lobstermen, not so easy. Turns out, you know, it's a very protected kind of industry, and in order to get a boat and a license and get your little piece of the ocean, it's very complex. So this guy, Pearl Hardy, was really forthright and told me a lot of wonderful stories about fishing and lobstering in Maine and how much this guy really loves it and loves what he calls the freelance fishing lifestyle. But lobster makes the world go round in Maine. I wrote a kind of funny essay called A Few Lobster Stories, because it's so remarkable how much Maine is identified with lobster. I mean, when you guys think about states all across the United States, it's hard to think of a state that is identified so strongly with a single food.
It's funny. Like, I agree with you, and I think there's one of my favorite little beers. It's not exactly the most complex beer in the world, but I don't even know if it's still made, but it was Geary's Pale Ale.
Yes, it is still made. It's delicious.
And of course, it has a picture of a lobster on right. the label. So, you know, even the beer has a picture of a lobster.
There's one state that I think has a more dominant food than you do. And that's Idaho and potatoes, yeah. So you're way ahead.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and Maine and potatoes as well, and, you know, maybe like New Mexico and chilies. But if you'll indulge me, can I read you one or two of these things
Please.
That I wrote about?
Absolutely.
Okay, so I said, as so much of this country and our culinary identity becomes homogenized, Maine has managed to hold on to many of its food traditions. No matter where I travel in the world, I am constantly reminded of the deep connection between my home state and Homaras Americanas, or Maine lobster. And then I tell these little stories. I'll just read you a few. Sitting in a restaurant in Beijing, China, when the waitress, wanting to try out her limited English, engages us in conversation. Where you come from, she asks. We live in Maine, in the northeastern part of the United States. Ah, Maine, I know, mean. And then she begins to move her fingers into pincers and pretends to attack me. That is where the, how you say it? Oh, the ocean, you know, the red fish, where the lobster lives. Ah, yes, you call it the lobster? So that's one story.
That's great.
And then, you know, it goes on and on about how no matter where I travel in the world, as soon as I tell people, oh, Maine, that's their identification.
Well, and you know, I mean, Kathy, you and I have served on a couple of panels before, and we're sort of running the same food circles. And the wonderful thing about the Maine lobster industry is it is a small-scale industry. It is a small food producer industry. And the traditions, and the somewhat arcane traditions of Maine, have preserved, I mean, the lobster population in Maine is well cared for over generations. It's not under threat. The waters are protected by these lobstermen, and they're not overfished, and the large scale, tell me if I'm wrong about this, the large scale fishing that often leads to decimation of habitat and then move on to the next place isn't allowed to go on there.
Well, it is highly regulated. There are a lot of people who might hear what you say and take exception with it, because there are people that really believe that the waters are overfished. But according to Pearl Hardy and a few of the other lobstermen that I spoke to up in Deer Isle, they really feel like if you're legal and you follow the regulations, then we are safe for many, many generations to come. I mean, there's all kinds of rules about the size of the lobster. You're never allowed to pull up a molting lobster. You know, there's a lot of, I think people understand that there's fourth, in some cases fifth generation lobstermen in Maine. They want their kids and their kids' kids and their kids' kids' kids to be able to do this and have this really important industry stay alive. So many people take it seriously, but there are others who disagree, who really do feel that the waters are being overfished everywhere.
Well, you know, even though the argument is about the debate of how much should be pulled out of the water, they're having the argument and they're having the discussion. With it, everyone has an eye to preserving the fish and to preserving the fish for generations. And and it's happening among small food producers who are parts of a community and want to see that community endure. Now, they may be arguing about the particulars, but at least that's how the discussion is happening.
Absolutely.
As opposed to how it happens elsewhere, which is, you know, there are fleets of ships who will come in and scoop up every fish and destroy the habitat that created those fish.
Exactly.
in a couple of days or a couple of weeks, and not care if it ever comes back, because those ships can go someplace else.
Exactly. I mean, there's a sense of propriety, there's a sense of tradition and of respecting the land and keeping the water clean so that we can continue to eat these lobsters and not be afraid of what we're taking in. And, you know, I mean, Pearl Hardy, I spoke to him last summer, and so it was almost a year after the New Orleans oil spill. And, you know, to talk to a fisherman in Maine, it was really interesting. He said, when something like that happens in New Orleans, it doesn't just happen to New Orleans. It happens to everyone. He said he felt shook up for several months because he realized that could happen here, you know, its own version of it, of a ship, an oil spilling, or a pollution control issue. And so there's very much a sense of, we have to take care of the waters and we have to take care of this industry if we're going to keep this alive.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because one of the things that Francis and I know from talking about lobsters for all these years as we have is that, you know, you mentioned earlier in the show that this is kind of a highly regulated industry, but a lot of the people who are regulating it are the lobstermen. It's not just the government. The lobstermen will let you know if you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, very much so, and that's right. That's why you wouldn't be allowed in so easily. There's a lot of fighting with the government up there, though, too. I mean, I talked to another guy, I'm blanking out on his name, Robbins is his last name, and he runs a co-op up there, and he's gotten really political, and his whole thing is that if the lobstermen stay united and they show up at political events and they voice their opinion about things, they have huge power in numbers, like any union, really.
Well, it's good that they do. But let's get back to the book for a moment. I mean, of course, the main ingredient of your home state of Maine is lobsters. But the book, Notes from a Maine Kitchen, I didn't read the subtitle before. It says seasonally inspired recipes. One of the things being owning restaurants in New Jersey that we've always talked about, and we've been running a green market-driven restaurant since 1992, you know, we put up a lot of food in the summertime to use in the wintertime. There are, you know, the cruel months of December, January, February, and March, and even April, where what's available seasonally and locally is mostly snow, which you can melt into water.
Delicious.
Has nothing to do with the color green.
So, and you're further north than we are, so talk about seasonality in a Maine kitchen.
Well, it's one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book, too, is that so many people come to Maine 2 or 3 months of the year. They see it in all its glory. It's warm, it's sunny, and it's gorgeous. But the truth is that it's gorgeous all year, and that it is a struggle if you are the kind of cook or a chef, or if you own a restaurant or a business, to eat locally year-round. So there's two interests. I mean, January was a lot of fun. I went smelt fishing with Chef Sam Hayward, who runs 4th Street in Portland. We went up onto the Cassance River, We went 2 miles up the frozen river to a little ice shack. I'd never been ice fishing before. It turned out to be one of the great days. We caught over 100 fish in just a few hours. And to eat these fresh smelt, fresh, you know, we caught them and cooked them within an hour or so of each other. It was so incredible and really brought up this whole issue of local seasonal food. I mean, I was driving home with this bucket of smelts. We had just gone back to Sam's house and coated them in some Maine cornmeal with fresh cracked pepper and Maine sea salt and heated up a cast iron skillet really, really hot and just fried these smelts for 2 or 3 minutes on each side. And it was like eating cucumber. It had that kind of fresh, really nuanced, interesting flavor. And I thought, my God, it's January, and I just caught 100 fish, and I can eat these for the next few days and know that this is the freshest food you could possibly find in Maine in January. And then in February, I devoted a whole essay to the rise of winter farmers market. This is a fairly new phenomenon in Maine. I would say it's literally only about 3 or 4 years old. And I can now go to a farmers market all year long. There's a wonderful greenhouse near where I live, and about 30 local farmers come and bring their root vegetables and their homemade cheeses and their fresh baked breads and their apple cider and anything and everything that you can keep through the winter. So February is suddenly not so horrible a month because of these markets. And I had a lot of fun creating recipes for root vegetables and just really appreciating the sweetness in a root vegetable and roasting them and making salads and making soups. And so there are recipes that take you through the whole year focusing on what is in season then.
Well, and you sort of preserve the season as we do. One of the things we started in our restaurant in the last, 5 years? We've really gotten into it in earnest.
7 years.
7 years is canning. You know, we put up a lot of fruit in the summertime. We actually in the restaurant tend to put up a lot of fruit in liquor, which we then use the fruit either in the bar or in the kitchen, and then we use the liquid behind the bar mostly.
And we also do tons of tomatoes
for the Italian restaurant. And, you know, preserving your own local fruit and vegetables, I find that is, you know, no one can make Catherine Lombardi's tomato sauce. It's not possible.
Yeah,
no one can
imitate.
If you had the recipe, you couldn't make it unless you stole a jar of our tomatoes. And I like that, and I think people are looking for differentiation like that. You devote some time to canning in your book. Will you talk to us about what you like to see a home cook can, what you think someone should can to provide things through
the year? Definitely. The entire month of September is all about canning and preserving fruits and vegetables. The thing about canning is until you do it and have a good time doing it, which is crucial, you're scared of it. Most people I know are like, oh, yeah, my grandmother did that, or, oh, my aunt in the Midwest did that. And then as I talk and I explain what I do and how simple it is, you can see their eyes kind of lighting up because there is this great myth that it's a very complex art, when in fact it's so simple. I talk in the book about how towards the end of every September I have what I call a canning party where I invite about 6 or 8 friends who are all gardeners, and everybody brings their produce. So they harvest their gardens, they harvest their fruit trees, they harvest their blueberry bushes, their apple trees, their pear trees. We all get together and we just cook all day. At night, we put on some good music, a little James Brown, and we cook and we can, and it's suddenly a party. And what happens is you wake up the next morning and you have hundreds of jars of gorgeous produce there. So really what I've tried to do is bring it down, make it really simple. There are so many websites, the USDA, there's so many different ways to know if what you're doing is right. That seems to be what scares people most. Like, am I going to poison my family? Am I going to poison my friends? And once you can a jar of tomato sauce or peach butter or apple jam, all these recipes are in my book, you know, there's no going back, because in February when you open that jar of tomato sauce, as you were just saying, it's like heaven. It's like the whole garden comes back to you, and you can't get food like that in February.
I have a buddy who lives up in North Jersey, John, and his wife Joanne, and they live up in North Jersey, and her parents have a tradition, and her grandparents have a tradition where they basically have everybody come over the house on a given Sunday in late August, September, and it's a canning party.
Yeah.
And everybody can, and they can tomatoes for, you know, the entire day. And everybody from multiple generations is involved in this canning tomato day. And then if you know John or his family, you get a can of tomatoes at Christmas time.
Yeah.
It's great. It's
well,
just,
that's
it's
the thing. You get all these gifts. And, you know, just to tell you how simple it can be, for instance, I take, there's a lot of blueberries around Maine. There's beautiful, tiny, wild Maine blueberries, which are full of antioxidants, and they're supposed to be so great for you. So I, you know, I'll spend a day harvesting blueberries, and then I come back, and I'll just sometimes freeze them as is. But I've been making a blueberry syrup, which is simply, you know, a cup and a half of water, half a cup of sugar, boil it down for 5 minutes, a simple syrup like you'd make for any bar. And then you throw a few cups of these wild blueberries in, take it off the heat, and let it really infuse. And then you strain it, and you have the most gorgeous blueberry color, blueberry fragrant syrup. And then I use that to make homemade blueberry soda. I throw it into champagne or sparkling wine. You make cocktails with it. And again, you can freeze it in little ice cube trays and pop out a wild blueberry syrup cube, and you have that fresh, vibrant flavor of summer all winter long. And it makes a damn good cocktail.
And we should also point out that, you know, I think that when we open, especially around Christmas time, you know, the fruits, I think the fruits and liquor are a little more expensive and a little more celebratory. But when you open anything that you've put up in the summer and it's the holiday time, it's just, you know, you're open. It's a labor of your hands. And that doesn't really, and it's completely unique and yours, something you made, you know.
Absolutely. It's a gift of love.
Yeah, and that just doesn't happen anymore. And it's really, people love it and react well to it. So that's a great section in the book. And we do want to point out that if you're going to can stuff, you need to educate yourself just on, if you have an old canning recipe, like what your grandmother had, don't use that one as far as cook times if you're gonna seal it and can it. Because
good point.
They weren't as safe back then. We know a lot more about how long you need to sterilize or boil cans of different
sizes. The USDA has a great site online, and so does the ball jars. You know, they make the great old, you know, canning jars. There's so much solid information online now that you can find out anything and everything you need to know about canning. But I did devote a whole chapter to it, and I think you can learn quite a bit reading this chapter.
Absolutely. And the only other thing I want to caution people for, I was talking to someone once who said, well, yeah, I just used the tomato canning recipe for the asparagus. And I said, no. There are different recipes for different things because you need a certain level of acidity, and they all affect, but all that information is on there at the USDA website, and this book is a terrific, terrific canning book. Hey, listen, Kathy, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Sounds great.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and restaurantguysradio.com.
Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Kathy Gunst is our guest. Her new book, Notes from a Maine Kitchen, is available now. You can find out more about it at restaurantguysradio.com. We were talking about canning. We've talked about lobsters. But the other ingredient that we think of when we think of the northern states and Maine and Vermont and New York State is maple syrup, right? Maple is important up there.
very important, and I tell a kind of funny story in my March chapter. Obviously, we haven't really said this explicitly, but the book follows the calendar year. We start in January, we end in December, but March is maple time, and we have a few really huge old maple trees on our property, and every year my husband kind of gets into collecting the sap like, I don't know, like some guys go fishing, I guess. He literally just disappears. So we collect the sap over a period of a few weeks. And then on a few very cold nights, he will go into our barn where he has set up this ridiculous-looking rig, and he boils the sap down. And he has our dog out there, and he has the New York Times, and he just hangs out and cooks the sap down. And it's kind of this, I don't know, male ritual up here. A lot of women do it as well, but I've talked to a bunch of people, and they're like, oh, my God, my husband does that. But anyway, the real joy of it is it takes 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of syrup. So that gives you an idea of how long it takes to cook down.
Can I share with you one funny story?
Please.
A friend of mine, a guy I knew, told me a story about how he had moved up north, and he decided that he was going to make some maple syrup, and so he got the sap. And he puts them on huge stock pots in his kitchen and just sets them to boiling inside the house.
Uh-oh, I know where this story's going.
The wallpaper came off the walls, yeah. Things. It was just, he filled the house with moist humidity that basically melted everything in his home.
Think about it. You're simmering sugar,
right?
Yeah.
Right. So we got ants. One year we did it indoors, and we learned really quickly, this is a bad idea.
Oh, because the ants smell
like
the sugar in the air?
Well, it's not just in the air. Now it's on the walls.
Yeah.
It got on our wooden beams. It got on the ceiling. It was bad news. It was like, okie dokie, we learned that lesson.
Don't do this at home.
No.
So in the barn, does he have it rigged to exhaust outside?
He has the barn doors open, even though it's freezing cold, and he's got, you know those things they sell to cook lobster outside? You hook it up to a probe? Mm-hmm. That's what he uses. He gets, like, two of those going, and he's got these kind of big lasagna pans out there, and he just keeps pouring in sap, and it's pretty much like magic because it goes from basically tasting like heavily diluted sugar water to all of a sudden it gets that gorgeous amber buttery color, and it turns this, you know, exquisite color, and you taste it, and all of a sudden it's syrup, and what we call the first run, so it's the first batch of sap, which is really the purest kind. It literally tastes like somebody melted a stick of butter in it. It's that kind of consistency. It's much thinner than regular maple syrup, and if we give you a jar of first run, it means we really love you.
Kathy, I was just about to say, I guess I know what you can send me for Christmas this year.
I was going to say, I'll be watching the mails around Christmas time, Kathy. You know, it's funny, the difference between that first run, which is beautiful almost by itself, and then you're now having, I'm seeing barrel-aged maple syrups from first run that are pretty wild
and
interesting.
Yeah, this is kind of new. There's all kinds of things. People are experimenting with infusing other flavors into it. I'm kind of a purist. I'm not sure how I feel about that. The most hilarious thing to me is that maple syrup is now being labeled as organic. It's like, explain to me how you could have a non-organic maple syrup.
Oh, give it time, Kathy. Give it time.
If you spray your maple trees, I guess, but it's just like the very nature of what it is it's an organic substance that comes out of a tree when the days turn warm and the nights are cold. What happens.
Let's see if I can push Kathy's buttons a little bit. And how would you compare that to, say, Mrs. Butterworth?
Log cabin.
What's in the story? How would you describe the difference?
Oh, it's pretty much the same. Yeah.
Log cabin's cheaper. That's all.
It's like, I remember I was once interviewing Marcella Hazan, and I asked her what the difference was between real Parmigiano Reggiano and, like, Kraft
Parmesan,
you know,
cheese.
Parmesan. She said, that's sawdust.
That's
and
enough.
I thought, that's kind of like how I feel about your question.
Well,
the difference I see, if I had to make an analogy, it's like the difference between log cabin and maple syrup is like the difference between butter and Elmer's paste.
Elmer's paste. Okay, I thought you were going to say Crisco.
But just to let people know what it is. I mean, that's just corn syrup, and that's not that has nothing to do with maple syrup.
It's just it's got a fake maple flavor, and it's corn syrup, and it has nothing to do with maple syrup. And, you know, it gets back to something that comes up with every aspect of food, which is a lot of people were saying, well, why should you pay that much for it? And my whole philosophy about this is that to eat well is it should not be an expensive thing that only certain people can afford. If you have really fresh seasonal food, it tastes so good that you tend to eat less of it.
I was just about to say
more.
That.
Like the maple syrup, you don't need to pour it all over your toast or your pancakes or your cereal the way you do with that crap because you're getting real flavor.
My kids eat one quarter of the amount of maple syrup that they would of, you know, log cabin or something like that if they were to pour it all over their pancakes. And, yeah, it's four times more expensive, but
right.
Doesn't that just make it the same?
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Except one tastes good and one tastes like crap.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really unfortunate. You know, but I think what we're all involved in and what we can all, I don't know, I think it's an important thing that we do is that we talk about this and we talk about it in a non-accusatory way. And I love sharing this with people. Like, we have a restaurant, they're not an inexpensive restaurant, either of our restaurants, but with my nephews and nieces, with my friends, I like to share the real maple syrup with people who may not know, because I tell you, the level of food ignorance out there, they may not say it on the label. I mean, some of them say maple flavored syrup, some of them just say syrup, and it's corn syrup with brown stuff in it to make
it
brown.
Again, it's like so many other things. I mean, if you're not raised eating the real thing, you're not going to know that there's this unbelievable flavor out there that you've missed. There's an entire generation that was raised on microwave food.
Yeah. Well, and with maple syrup, I think this is a perfect example of, I think there are a lot of folks who think they know what maple syrup is, yet have never had maple syrup.
The real thing, yeah.
You know, and I think part of what we do is to expose people to that. All of
us. Yeah, and it's not an ingredient that's hard to find. I mean, you need to look. Just to take you through the cycle, so that first batch, what we call the first run, or some people would call grade A, then it goes, you know, then it gets a little bit darker and more intense, and then the next level, grade C, or extra dark, or amber dark, as it's called, is absolutely delicious, too. It's really great to cook with. I make barbecue sauces with it, marinade things, glazed ducks, glazed turkeys. It, you know, you don't have to have this first run to get a really pure maple flavor.
A lot of bartenders will tell you that they'd rather use the B or the C level maple syrup because the tastes are different and more in your face.
We do. We always use B syrup in our cocktails.
You know why? It's a more pronounced flavor. Mm-hmm. The thing about this first run is that it's full of subtlety, so you would never want to put it into a cocktail. You know, it would be lost. But mostly what we do with it is take a spoonful and sit there and close our eyes and say, oh, my God, this is so good.
Well, now, you have in your book, in the end, one of the things I think is very helpful, you have stories and recipes, and in the end you have sort of suggested menus, which I think are really great for a home cook. You have an Italian night, a hot summer night, a winter brunch, a spring brunch, weeknight dinner, a snow day dinner. I think that's, people find that very helpful to sort of say, okay, I gotta come up with a meal plan, and here it is.
Yeah, these are just suggested menus. There's about 75 recipes in the book, and it was really fun to put these menus together and see how things paired with each other, because if you eat in season and you eat locally, it becomes pretty obvious what you are going to eat in February versus August. You know, you're not going to have corn on the cob in February because it comes from somewhere very far away and it tastes like starch. But so, yeah, it was a lot of fun putting together these party menus and everyday menus.
So it's sort of a roundup question. Do you think that people who eat well in Maine eat differently than in other places? And if there's a difference in how people eat in Maine, what is it? How is to eat in a Maine way differently than the rest of the country?
One of the big myths about Maine is that it's just about lobsters and blueberries. Maine, Portland in particular, has become a very sophisticated food city. We have 3 James Beard Award-winning chefs running restaurants here. I mean, it's no longer like a backwoods kind of place. This has also become a state that has attracted a lot of young farmers and young entrepreneurs who are really interested in making the best French bread or the best chowder or the most amazing pies. And consequently, since I've lived here over the 30 years, you had to pretty much eat lobster or go to like a bean in the hole supper to get something really interesting and regional. And now there is so much good food in Maine. You know, do we eat better than other states? Probably. We don't have the diversity that you would find in New York or L.A. or some of the major cities. We don't have all the ethnic groups, but there is a wealth of really interesting, very sophisticated food here. And I think that's a big surprise for people who come in the summer, eat lobster 3 days in a row, and go home.
I just from reading your book, I can see that's the case. If we were to post one recipe up on the Restaurant Guys radio site, what recipe would it be?
Well, I might suggest the roasted wild mushroom soup because mushrooms are abundant right now. Again, you have to be really safe. You should never go foraging without a professional. But if you go to a farmer's market or a really terrific fruit and vegetable store, you'll see four, five, sometimes six varieties of mushrooms. And in this recipe, what I do is very untraditional. You actually roast the mushrooms, all these different varieties with some onion and sage and rosemary, and you deglaze the pan with a little sherry or wine and then add broth and puree it. That is an exquisite soup for this time of year.
If you would like to make that soup, you can go to restaurantguysradio.com, go to the Kathy Gunst Show, click on links and recipes, and there you'll find it. Kathy, thanks for coming on the show. The
thanks, Kathy.
Thanks so much. It was great to talk to you guys.
Kathy Gunst has been our guest. Her book is Notes from a Maine Kitchen, Seasonally Inspired Recipes. You can find out more about the book and even get a free recipe from it at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to us on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. You know, Kathy Gunst is great. I sat with her on a panel with Leonard Lopate and just a few other radio personalities. We did something for it was just a panel we gave to the public. It was really very interesting, and she was great. And she told me about the book about a year ago, and I had dinner with her at the time, and I've been looking forward to the book, and I was really pleased by it.
Well, you know, we're really into canning and that whole bit of it. So as soon as I got into that part of the book, I was like, oh, this is the kind of book for me. But we talked about canning a little bit during the show. Recently, Francis and I went to a wedding of a former employee, and you know that we touched her life a little bit because what she gave out as wedding favors was food that her and her now husband had canned together.
Yeah, that's great.
And they did pickles and a bunch of other things. And,
really, so
and
sweet.
That was the gift that they gave to everybody at the end of the wedding, and it was heartfelt, and it was part of them, and it just. You know, I go to a lot of weddings, and sometimes the favors are not so favorable.
Well, no, I think, you know, because, look, I mean, if your resources are unlimited, you're spending a lot of money on a wedding to begin with, and then to say, oh, well, you know, it's hard to find something nice for $10. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you have 100 people at your wedding, that's $1,000. So
well,
if you spend $25.
Nice. It's something nice that says something about you. Well, and I think that's what a lot of people miss with the wedding favor, that you want something that commemorates the day.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Well, I think you can get something that has, I mean, you give wine openers out at your wedding, as I recall. And that wine opener lived in my drawer for about 10 years.
Well, the beauty is, and then I got to, whenever I went to anybody's house, I would look at the wine opener and it said, Mark and Jennifer, August 29th, 1993.
So it reminded you of your anniversary?
Mark and Jennifer, August 29th, 1993. Mark and Jennifer, August 29th, 1993.
Can I tell you that, Mark?
So now you all know my anniversary as I know it from the wine opener.
Mark, is it bad that when you say that it's like you're a prisoner who has to give his name, rank, and serial number? Is that bad? I think it is.
You know, it's years ago, I was at a Bill Cosby show, and he's like, how long have you been married? And I'm like, I don't know, but August 29th, 1993. Because he was testing husbands to see if they knew how long they had been married. But so I can't do math, but August 29th, 1993. So I may not know the number of years that I've been married, but here's one thing I do know. Kathy mentioned earlier in the show that she was ice fishing for smelts.
Nah, ice fishing, no.
I was like, you know, I got a good buddy who lives in Minnesota who has been trying to get me to go ice fishing for years now.
Same buddy. I got
and
the same buddy.
And I'm like,
he doesn't even ask me.
There is no way. And you know, usually people ask you, like, to do something or to go somewhere, and you're like, oh, I don't know, we'll see. He asked me to go ice fishing, I'm like, no way.
You know, it's funny, I always thought that, and I went ice fishing with my dad when I was younger on Lake Hopatcong in New Jersey when it used to freeze over really solid. And we didn't really, I'm getting a friend, our buddy, who he probably does it better than my dad and my uncles did, because we had a little shack and it was cold and we sat on our butts and it was like a pack on. And so like a fish, an hour came out and I couldn't drink the beer because I was too young. And even if I could, I did. Oh, it was awful. It was awful.
I think basically what they do is they go out to the shack and they fish and they get drunk. But I can fish and get drunk without being so cold.
I can just get drunk and play a fishing video game is what I can do. No, but, you know, I've seen on television and on the Internet some people who do this, and they set up really nice shacks, and the shacks aren't very cold.
Knowing this guy, he probably sets up a really nice shack, and he probably drinks really good beer, and he probably has a really good time out there. I don't know. I just want to sit in the living room and drink beer. I don't want to sit on an ice pond.
I've seen some of these ice shacks, and they're built like little houses, and it is like a living room on the ice pond, and it's as if you could cut a hole in the floor of your living room and go fishing with it, just keep your shoes on. You know, I don't know. Still not rushing to get out there.
If any of our listeners want to convince me that I should go ice fishing, feel free to send me an email, but I don't think so.
Well, and the other thing is, if I knew I could go out there and get 100 fish an hour and then fry them up right away and eat them, I'd be much more enticed to do so. But still not all that enticed. Anyway, I hope you guys have enjoyed the hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
And you're listening to us at The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com.